Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
With Justin Brierley.
Welcome along to Unbelievable, the show from Premier Christian Radio in the UK, broadcasting around the world as a podcast and bringing you conversations that matter between Christians and skeptics every week. I'm Justin Brierley, thrilled to be bringing you today the sixth and final episode of our big conversation series from Unbelievable, where I've been sitting down with some of the biggest thinkers in the Christian and atheist world to talk about science, faith, philosophy, and what it means to be human. It launched back in June, and we've seen five sparkling conversations so far between people like Jordan Peterson, Susan Blackmore, John Lennox, Daniel Dennett, Stephen Pinker, Darren Brown, and more. And it has been such a privilege to be able to put this series together, and we're hoping to bring you another season of The Big Conversation next year. So watch this space. Well, all six episodes are available now to watch as videos at the Big Conversation website. Can I encourage you to watch and share the brand new video of today's discussion? And while you're there, sign up for the Unbelievable newsletter and you'll be notified of new episodes, bonus content and extra resources. That's all at thebigconversation.show. Also links there to the Unbelievable app featuring the podcast, articles and bonus content all in one place on your mobile device. So do look out for that in your app store too. But without further ado, let's sit back and listen to the final episode of The Big Conversation 2018. Welcome to The Big Conversation here on Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. The Big Conversation is a series of shows exploring faith, science, philosophy, and what it means to be human in association with the Templeton Religion Trust. Today, our conversation topic is evolution, morality, and being human. Do we need God to be good? The Big Conversation partners I'm sitting down with today are Peter Singer and Andy Bannister. Peter Singer is Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University and a noted moral philosopher. He's the author of books such as Animal Liberation, Practical Ethics, and The Most Good You Can Do. Peter's an atheist and has argued that our view of morality and human value shouldn't be driven by religious views about the sanctity of life, but by the ability of any living thing to have preferences and cognitive faculties. Andy Bannister is a Christian thinker and speaker with the Solas Center for Public Christianity and author of the book The Atheist Who Didn't Exist or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. He believes that morality and human value are tied to the fact that humans are created in God's image. He believes that while Peter's viewpoint is consistent with his atheism, it has chilling consequences for our commitment to human rights. Well, today we're going to be asking, what is the basis for the value we ascribe to human life? Is right and wrong something we invent in the evolutionary struggle for survival? Or is morality discovered as part of the fabric of the universe and grounded in a source beyond ourselves, namely God? So welcome along to the programme, both Peter and Andy. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Justin. Good to be here.
Peter, we'll start with you. You're an atheist. Is that a point of view you adopted early on in your life?
I think I was probably never really a religious believer. In my early teens, I had some doubts and might have called myself an agnostic or something like that. But yes, for most of my life, I've thought that, you know, one can never totally exclude the possibility, I suppose, that there is a God. But it seems to me to be so improbable that I'm prepared to describe myself as an atheist.
Have you ever met any kind of argument that's given you pause for thought or had any inclination towards wishing that there might be a God?
Oh, one could always wish that there might be a God, as long as it was a better God than the one who is supposed to have created this world. I don't know that I would really want there to be such a God, but if there were a God who was going to look after everything and prevent the suffering of innocent beings, which is obviously a major feature of this world, that would be terrific. But, you know, that's just like wishing there were fairies in the bottom of your garden.
I mean, from your point of view, do you tend to live your life and the ethics you espouse on the basis that this life is all we've got? This is obviously the one life we have. Yeah. In a sense, you've made quite a name for yourself in this area. And in some respects, you've become quite a controversial figure as well to some groups. For instance, those who advocate for disability rights and so on have protested sometimes some of the statements you've made and the events you've been at. What is it about what you say that promotes that kind of a reaction, would you say?
If you're asking specifically about the reaction of people who are advocates for disability rights, it's probably merely that I state things that a lot of other people believe and indeed act on. Because after all, it's very common for people to have prenatal testing to see whether a fetus that they're carrying will have a disability. And in most of these cases, for example, if the disability is Down syndrome, typically something like 85% of the pregnant women will opt to terminate the pregnancy. And, you know, I think that that's a defensible decision. And I think it's a defensible decision because I think it's reasonable to prefer to have a child without Down syndrome than one with Down syndrome. But because I say that explicitly, whereas other people are just doing it in the privacy of their medical clinics and decisions, I think I attract opposition from people who try to maintain that, you know, life with disabilities is just as good, and we should not, as they say, discriminate against people with disabilities. But obviously, as I say, you know, most people do discriminate, and I think that's a justifiable form of discrimination.
And when it comes to those kinds of issues, how do you arrive at the view that, you know, it's preferable, if you like, to not have a child with disability and so on? What's the kind of the ethic that you've been promoting?
Well, the cases which are easiest are ones where the child will suffer significantly if they are born with a disability. And for that purpose, I'd have to say Down syndrome is probably not a good example. I chose it merely because it's a common disability and people do opt to terminate pregnancies with Downs. But the underlying ethic that I hold is a utilitarian ethic, that is, that we ought to try to reduce the amount of suffering in the world. We ought to try to promote the amount of well-being, happiness, however you want to describe it in the world. That I think that when you have children born particularly with conditions that lead them to suffer greatly or ones that are very difficult for their parents to cope with, and again, especially in societies that don't provide good support for that, then I think it's a reasonable choice to say I'd rather have a child without that condition.
And this touches as well on the whole question of how you view a child as opposed to, say, a full-grown adult with lots of options in front of them and preferences and so on. You've developed the idea of personhood being the important thing when it comes to the kinds of value and rights we should ascribe to a person. Do you want to just explain what that is?
Yes, I'm happy to explain that, but it's slightly misleading to say that I think personhood is somehow important. I simply have used the term person to refer to beings who have a sense of their future and have preferences for that future. And that's really what I think is important and what underlies those decisions. And it's particularly clear where somebody is able to make choices. Then I think, you know, most people would see the difference between somebody who can make a choice whether they want to go on living or not. And I think under certain conditions, we ought to try to respect that choice. And other circumstances where you have someone who's incapable of making that choice, possibly because they don't even have the sense of themselves as an independent being living at present but with a possible future.
And in that sense, for you, it's not so much about every human having a specific intrinsic value, but rather the value is more attached to any living thing's ability to reason, to have preferences, to have options. If
or merely to be capable of suffering and enjoying their life.
Right.
Yes. Certainly, that's another aspect of my view, that I think what species a being is not in itself morally crucial. Mm. So if by being human you mean being a member of the species Homo sapiens, and people do run those two things together, of course, I don't think that that's in itself morally decisive. I think that we ought to look at beings for what they are. And, of course, there are some non-human animals who are more capable of understanding their situation in the world, of making choices, and certainly more capable of suffering and enjoying their lives than some very profoundly disabled, particularly profoundly intellectually disabled members of the species Homo sapien.
And obviously a lot of what you've done is focus on the ethics around animals and animal welfare and so on. That's an important part of your body of work. I suppose it has led to those situations where some people are concerned that you care more almost about animals than humans sometimes. I mean, that's obviously the way they characterize it. What would you say to those who, you know, when you run that thought experiment about is it better to save a burning barn of pigs or, you know, a one-week-old baby and so on, is that sort of helpful or is that not really what you're talking about?
Well, it's certainly misleading to say that I care more about animals than about humans, and I'd like to know exactly what those people are doing for humans. Another aspect of my thought that we haven't yet talked about is that I think that people like us living in the affluent world ought to be doing a great deal more for people in extreme poverty than we are, and that's one of the easiest things we can do to help humans. The fact that there are people living on $2 a day, whereas we spend $2 on a cup of coffee without a moment's thought, says to me that there's something wrong with this. We could we could double somebody's income for the day by sending them the money we spend on a cup of coffee. And of course, there's many more expensive things than that we spend money on that we don't need. So I not only preach that, if you like, I act on it. I give at the moment something like 30 to 40% of what I earn to effective charities that are helping people in extreme poverty. So if the people are saying that that's not enough, that we should all be doing more for our fellow humans, fine. I will admire them for doing that. But if they're not doing something comparable to that, I don't think they're in any position to say that I'm not caring about humans.
Interesting. We'll obviously be getting into the whole issue of the morality, evolution, the value of humans, with Andy Bannister, our other guest on the program today. Andy, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Justin. Always good to be here.
You've been engaging yourself in this area for some time. Before we get into that, just give us briefly your background. You've been a Christian for some time. What led you into wanting to engage in these sorts of areas of moral philosophy and, you know, how we ascertain good and wrong and right and wrong?
Yeah, so that's a wonderful couple of questions. So I was born and raised in a Christian home, but I think as listeners of this show who've encountered me before have heard me tell the story, I kind of sort of drifted away from that Christ as a faith, call it what you like, in my kind of late teens, where really I think I came across the sort of thought that I need to ascertain and be able to know whether the things I've been taught are actually true. And so I actually began pressing into this sort of era of philosophy and the reasons why we believe the things that we do. And then I think what really was significant in my journey is my academic background is not in philosophy, although this is going to be a fascinating conversation with Peter today. My PhD is Quranic studies. And I was having conversations with Muslim friends in London who were asking me very, very good questions about what I believed. And I realized I don't know anything about what they believed. And following that journey to its sort of logical conclusion actually led to doing a PhD and my doctoral work in Islamic studies, not biblical studies. And so my academic background is the study of the Quran. I'm still involved in lots of academic projects around that. But philosophy kind of developed as a sideline, because it's like a lot of graduate and postgraduate students, rather, I needed to pay the bills. And so when I was doing my PhD, I'd minored in philosophy earlier, and there was a need for the college where I was teaching to have somebody teach philosophy. So I sort of volunteered, and then not knowing actually that would be useful for these kind of public conversations, because part of my job at Solas is taking conversations about faith out of the doors of the church and into the public square. I spend most of my working life on university campuses, and actually philosophical questions come up.
Yeah.
And
on that basis, I'm sure you're regularly interacting with people who are atheistic in their outlook, like Peter. Where do you find the conversation often goes? Does it come to these kinds of philosophical issues around right and wrong, moral value, and so on?
I think what I really value about the chance to interact with Peter and Peter's, you know, work, which I read as a young student, I think is that actually so often when atheists and Christians, or others discuss, we can get into these sort of abstract questions of whether sort of God theoretically exists or whatever. But I like the kind of more practical end of philosophy. In fact, I remember, Peter, as I was sort of, refreshing my memory of your biography, I think you said somewhere that, when you were a young philosophy student, you decided you could sit around and just have, meaningless conversations about whether tables exist, or you could actually get out there and think about things that really matter. And I think questions of right and wrong, what does the good life look like, how should we live, that kind of, as you might put it, the pointy end of philosophy kind of interests me, because it gets it grounded in the real world. And I find questions around, good, evil, right, wrong, justice, meaning, purpose, those kind of things, they draw huge audiences, whether I'm talking in university settings or business settings. So that's what's intrigued me, that people are fascinated by the big questions of human life.
And ultimately, is it your view that these questions, the big questions, do point back to God at some level? Presumably you do believe that as a Christian.
Yeah, I think so. I think as Christians you have to be rather careful in going, how can we be good? Therefore God. Mm-hmm. Why is there a universe? Therefore God. I think that's quite a jump in logic, and philosophers and non-philosophers are sometimes guilty of, sort of doing great kind of leaps of thinking. But I do think I like the imagery of signposts. That's the one I often like to use with folks, of going, I think there are a number of signposts that taken together point in a significant direction. And I think it's interesting around the question of morality and human flourishing, which we're going to talk about in this conversation, that throughout the centuries, I think there's been a sort of a fair degree of recognition that I think having God there at the foundation does contribute something. And even if Peter and I end up disagreeing, which we will, I'd be foolish if I said that atheism had nothing to offer to the conversation. I don't think Peter, from what I've read, would turn around and dismiss the whole of Christian thinking on this. I think there's an area where we can have a discussion, and I think God contributes something to that discussion.
Yeah. Well, maybe opening up this whole area of whether humans have some intrinsic moral value or whether that's a wrong way of looking at the question. It's interesting that this is, I think, the 70th anniversary year of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Peter. And I was just looking it up the other day, and Article 1 states, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They're endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. I mean, do you fundamentally agree with that, or would you put it a different way, or would you say no, I don't think that's quite how it works?
It depends how we're supposed to take this, right? If we're supposed to take this as a kind of ringing declaration of things that we want to put out there and hold up in some way as a general principle, then I don't really have an objection to it. It may do quite a lot of good. But if we were to think of it as philosophers and to take it carefully and go through it word by word and analyze it, then I don't think that it is actually right. And also, of course, it is, as you say, a declaration of human rights, and as such, it tends to exclude, it does exclude non-human animals, and claims that all humans have dignity tend to imply that non-humans don't have the same kind of dignity that humans do, and I think that's not defensible either. Perhaps we should look at this term dignity for a start and say all humans are supposed to have this, whatever it means, right? So all humans includes those who are, let's say, anencephalics, right? An anencephalic is an infant born with only brain stem, with essentially no cortex, with no capacity for consciousness. An anencephalic will not smile at his or her mother, won't recognize his or her mother, presumably is not capable of experiencing or feeling anything at all. But that is a human being, same chromosomes and so on. Now compare that with a chimpanzee or a horse, or choose your favorite non-human animal, if you like. Why should we think that this human who can have no experiences has more dignity than the chimpanzee or the horse or the dog, who can respond in so many complex ways to their environment?
So essentially you would contest the statement, quite simply, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights.
There are exceptions.
And there are exceptions to that. And so in a sense that you couldn't, philosophically speaking, put your name to that kind of a declaration. You've done quite a bit of work on the idea of human rights.
Yeah, I mean, let me say a couple of things. One thing by way of response to Peter, but then flesh out my own thinking. I mean, I think what's interesting is, on the other hand, I think, Peter, while you, you know, take examples of human beings who are born profoundly disabled, I still think you'd recognise they had a degree of dignity there, because I think you'd, if you met a parent of a child who was born like that, who was proposing not just committing infanticide, but then chopping the corpse into little bits and frying them on the barbecue and having them with a salad, you'd think that in some way there'd been a failure of moral reasoning there to recognise that even in that tragedy there's a degree of dignity. But I think the confusion around extreme disability is actually something it's interesting. If you look at some of the great kind of ethicists throughout the centuries, people like Hobbes, Locke, can't argue the same thing, that the equality that we're talking about is not grounded in an ability that you have or you don't have, because that, of course, leads to a sliding scale that says, well, okay, maybe we say that rationality is what grants people, you know, inclusion in the moral community. Well, you're a brilliant philosopher. If we, you know, put you up next to Justin and we have to make a choice, Justin may not be part of our
moral
community.
I'd be mincemeat, yeah.
You would be mincemeat.
We could just say there's a minimal threshold, which Justin
passes. We could go that route, or we could go the route that Hobbes and Kant and others, and I think even some of the great utilitarian thinkers sort of flirted around with, that it's actually our capacities that are essential that are morally relevant. And I want to say something here about animal rights, Justin, because it was mentioned earlier on. That's a passion for me as well. And aside from the areas we'll disagree on, I think one thing I want to say that I hugely respect Peter for is that your book on animal liberation put animal rights and the way that we treat non-human creatures onto the table in a way that other books haven't. And so even though we may disagree on some things philosophically, I think you did a tremendous amount of good. What I would say, though, in terms of animal rights and justice for the animal kingdom, I want to say that's actually grounded in human dignity, because I have a duty to the animal kingdom to treat it a particular way. Now, if we're dealing with a higher form of life, such as a pig or a chimpanzee, I think that duty's there. But I would extend that and say that even if I treated something that didn't have sentience wrong in a way that was ill, or if I went out and, for example, set fire to vast tracts of rainforest, you know, plant life isn't sentient unless you follow one or two extreme philosophers, I have still behaved submorally. I have behaved in a way that's inappropriate towards that aspect of the natural world. But that's grounded in my duty that flows from my human nature, not in some sort of hypothetical set of rights that the entity out here has. So I think we might in some ways end up...
Whereas you do think that your duties to the anencephalic are grounded in some rights?
I think that it's, again, grounded in duty.
So you don't think there's a distinction then between the anencephalic and the pigs or the chimpanzees?
No, I think the human... I come back to where Justin put the question to you. I think that all human beings, whether they have the capabilities or they don't, belong to the human family, and with that come rights and dignity. So I would agree with the UDHR, but then I would ground animal rights, which is what you're also famous for, I would ground that in the same basis, on the same platform, because ultimately you and I know that I have a moral duty to the wolf. If a wolf breaks in here and eats one of the three of us, or Liam Neeson, as in the film The Grey, the wolf hasn't actually acted immorally. It has no duties to us.
Well, because the wolf doesn't have the capacity to make those choices, and that's why I would say, I would agree that the wrongdoing of the various acts you described, whether it's burning the rainforest or torturing a cat or doing something to humans, is grounded in the fact that we have the capacity to make choices and to think what those choices are. So we have moral agency, I would say, rather than our dignity, I'd say, is what it's grounded in. And the wolf lacks moral agency. The wolf just behaves as a wolf, I guess, sees something it can eat and goes ahead and tries to kill it and eat it. So, yes, there is a distinction between those humans capable of moral agency, which, of course, is not all humans. No babies are capable of moral agency, and non-human animals. But that's, I think, a different question from the question of whether, in terms of how we ought to treat them, we ought to put all humans, including the anencephalic, on a kind of higher plane by saying that they have rights that the others don't. And I think that's what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is trying to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's interesting is, I think actually, if I'm going to be iconoclastic, Peter and I may be on more common ground here, because I've for a long time suspected that I think rights language bogs us down a number of ways. If we're in favour of trying to see that animals are treated more fairly, we somehow feel we need to sort of start assigning rights to members of the animal kingdom. And in fact, actually, the rainforest example is not a random one. I think it was Brazil recently. Some politicians there are arguing that rainforests should be granted rights in order to protect them from logging. And I remember reading this and thinking, this is rights language gone mad. What I do think is that we have duty and responsibility and an oughtness. And it was interesting, actually. One of the things that I did to prepare for this discussion I was listening to the last time you were on the Unbelievable show, Peter, and you discussed with Christian philosopher Richard Weikart. And one of the things that Richard pushed you on was interesting. He pushed you on the sort of famous is ought dilemma in ethics. And you said something to the effect of, I should have written it down. I was driving in the car at the time, so I wasn't able to take the notes. So I had to remember the gist of what you said. But you said something to the effect of, I've spent most of my career trying to avoid the, you know, the is ought kind of issue. But then it was interesting, again, preparing for today, ought-based language is all over your work.
Okay. There's nothing wrong with ought-based language.
I ought to do X.
Of course.
Well, let me put this question to you in that sense then, Peter. So you believe in moral agency. You believe in, you know, that there is a right and wrong way to act with respect to other people and all the whole of the living world. I think for many people, like Andy would say, but where does that sense of moral duty come from, and what's it grounded in ultimately? Why should someone act in the best way they can towards, you know, why should someone adopt a utilitarian principle when they could simply say, well, I don't want to do that? In a universe where there is a God, where there is potentially some sort of moral arbiter, some kind of moral lawgiver, one may be able to find a way to saying, well, that's where this duty, this oughtness about the universe comes from. In a universe where there is no God, I think a lot of people ask, well, what is that grounded in? How can we get to this sense that we should act in certain
ways?
But
let's go back to the claim that in a universe in which there is a God, then it's grounded. Are we to say it's grounded simply in the will of God, in the arbitrary will of God? This is an argument, of course, that goes right back to Plato. Mm-hmm. Are we to say that if God had willed that, in fact, we cut up babies and eat them on the barbecue, then that would have been the right thing to do? Because I certainly wouldn't want to believe that, and I don't know whether Andrew wants to believe that. But if you reject that, then you have to say it's not arbitrary that God tells us that it's wrong to torture babies and that it's better to be kind to them, because that reflects a more basic underlying truth. And if there is such a more basic underlying truth that it's better not to, let's say, gratuitously cause pain, then that's something that we have access to and that can ground our action.
And is independent of God. So it's, yes, you seem to be stating Euthyphro's dilemma there, this idea that it's either...
You're right. You've picked up the reference
essentially, yes, does God command the good because it's good, or is the good what we should do independent of what God commands? This is a common response to the so-called moral argument.
And it was
God.
Interesting because Peter's so prolific, I refreshed my memory because I think the edition of Practical Ethics on my shelf was like an early one, perhaps not first edition, but I bought the more recent one on Kindle, and I'd forgotten. Of course, you had a reference in there early on to the Euthyphro dilemma. Slightly disappointed that you don't do much engagement with the literature, because, of course, as many people have pointed out, the answer to the Euthyphro dilemma is actually found in Plato himself. Because when Plato is positing that dilemma, he is using the word God and the gods really to describe the gods of Greek mythology, who are very much largely creatures within creation. They're much physical, they're physical beings. And then, of course, Plato puts forward the idea of the good, which in English we would probably tend to render that with a capital T and a capital G, who really is the kind of sort of metaphysical standard of goodness. It is the good. Mm. And Christian theists have always, generally since Augustine, connected those two and gone, aha, well, that's what Christian theism is talking about. It's not that God goes, well, what shall I command? Let's have some fun and command this. Or God looking to some standard outside of himself. But God is goodness, and therefore,
But for Plato, it's not a personal good. The good is not personal. Whereas presumably for Christians, it is.
I would absolutely agree with you there. That's a go. I think that's the difference.
So if I don't think, you know, I won't exactly accept Plato's metaphysics, but I could, let's say, well, yes, there is something that is objectively the good, and if you like, you know, it always is there and always would be there, has the potential to be there. So I could say it's timelessly true that to gratuitously inflict pain is a bad thing. But that doesn't get you anywhere in terms of saying there's a God, because this is not a personal being.
No, and that's a good question there. I mean, I would say a couple of things there, Peter. One is interesting. I forget where I read, but I read a recent interview with you where you made a comment to the effect of that you're just beginning to sort of nudge towards the idea that there may be standards of objective goodness.
Oh, I accept that. You're a few years out of date.
Well, it's not so much that. I read so much in the last... Okay. I think it was in the interview you did in 2016 with the Journal of Applied Ethics was where you were quoted as saying that. And I think that's interesting, because because actually I don't think you can avoid that. I mean, for example, I mean, Jeremy Bentham had the same issue. He ultimately had to admit the utility principle. You can't really give reasons for it. You have to take it as a foundation, which is interesting that you raise Plato, because I really think you're forced with two choices. You either have to posit a kind of personal god, like the god of Christian theism, or this sort of Platonic realm of things such as, you know, moral duties and those kind of things that are external to us and objective to us. They're discovered, and that was a question you raised at the start.
Well, it's time for a short break. I'm Justin Brierley bringing you the final episode of our big conversation series here on Unbelievable, as atheist moral philosopher Peter Singer debates Christian thinker Andy Bannister on the question, do we need God to be good? And you can watch the Technicolor video of this discussion at thebigconversation.show. And if you want bonus content and updates too, well, you'll get access if you sign up to the Unbelievable newsletter. Just one of the many perks of joining our mailing list. Do sign up, thebigconversation.show, and we'll be back with part two very soon.
Hello and welcome to the program that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading skeptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show, our sixth episode today of The Big Conversation. Not just a radio show and podcast, this is also a high-quality video series at thebigconversation.show. Today's discussion continues between Princeton ethics professor Peter Singer and Andy Bannister of the Solas Center for Public Christianity. Let's join them again as we begin to discuss whether belief in moral right and wrong points towards God. So you do believe at some level, Peter, in the idea of objective moral values and duties.
Yes.
And those things exist independently of us, in a sense, in our evolutionary history and that.
Yes, the word exist could be misinterpreted. But perhaps you could say in a similar way to mathematical truths existing. And again, there's a lot of discussion among philosophers as to how you understand mathematics. But
And in that sense, rather than us inventing the things that we think are good, they actually exist independent of us. We discover them in that sense. And obviously, that seems to cohere, many would say, with Christian theism, the idea that there is a God who has, as it were, woven this into the fabric of the reality that we live in. But it's harder to reconcile with naturalism, which I assume is
I'm not a naturalist.
You're not a naturalist. What are you?
I'm not a naturalist in the ethical sense.
Okay.
Right? I can describe myself as a naturalist in terms of understanding the universe, broadly speaking.
I see.
But not in every respect, perhaps.
Where does the realm then, if it exists, where is it?
When we're talking about ethics, naturalism is the idea that Andrew referred to before, that you can derive ought judgments from is judgments. In other words, that you can go from facts to values. I don't think that's true. I think that there are independent normative truths, which, as I say, I'm a little doubtful about saying they exist. If that suggests that in some sense there is a realm where these things could be discovered or seen, but I think that they're something that we have access to, as we have access to principles of logic or principles of mathematics, that if we're rational beings, we can understand them.
That's interesting, because I meet many atheists who deny that altogether.
Yes, there's another view, which I did hold for a good bit of my career, which says that essentially when we make moral judgments, we're expressing attitudes, and these attitudes are not really true or false, or sometimes people say prescriptions. My former Oxford teacher, R.M. Hare, said that they're prescriptions, that we're prescribing things, which again are not true or false, just as if I say to you, shut the window, that's not true or false. It's a command. It's not, not a description. It's not like saying the window is shut. So that is another possible position right. that many philosophers hold. And as
and
I
what's,
say
what's led you to the belief that actually there really is this objective realm of moral values and duties?
So for a long time, I tried to reconcile the non-objectivist, if you like, the prescriptivist view with the idea that reason plays a role in reaching ethical conclusions. And I tried to do that broadly within the framework that R.M. Hare had set out. But eventually I concluded that couldn't really be done. And at the same time, I was persuaded by a number of philosophers. Derek Parfit is one who's been influential with me, Tim Scanlon, Tom Nagel, that it's reasonable to think that there are normative truths that are objective, that we don't have to go into any really weird metaphysics in order to accept that.
So we don't live in a world where we're all beholden to basically whatever everyone's opinion is on their particular morality. It's not subjective in this. We can say, right. If you're behaving wrongly, you ought to be behaving this way.
We can certainly say that, and I'd go further and say, in saying that, we're not just expressing our own attitude, like we're saying, I really like a lot of garlic in my spaghetti sauce, and someone else says, no, I don't like garlic. We're talking about something where there is a right or wrong answer.
So why, for you, should this make Peter at least open to the possibility of theism, Andy, rather than a sort of whatever, maybe Platonic realm?
Well, I want to say a couple of things before that, Justin. I mean, the first thing I want to say is I want to be very careful because in the context of this being a collegial discussion, it's very tempting for both Christians and for atheists to sort of try and find gotcha moments and go, I've just got Peter admitting. And I want to be careful in doing that. What I want to then say as well, I also respect, I think, how Peter arrived at that position, because I think if you do say that ethical statements have no content, they're meaningless. I mean, that was something sort of right out of the whole sort of annals of logical positivism and A.J. Ayres and others, we end up with a very strange counterintuitive conclusion that somebody who decides they prefer helping the poor and giving lots of money away to help people in difficult parts of the world, that's no different from somebody who decides they want to, you know, invade Eastern Europe and try and, you know, start the Third Reich. And there's no difference between them. And that's so counterintuitive, something's got to be wrong with it. I also want to say as well that I think the other thing I think that's interesting around ethics is ethics requires grounding in a framework. I don't think you can do ethical statements like you could do mathematics. Ethics belongs in the context of relationships, and that's sometimes why ethicists go wrong. They kind of abstract things from the context of family and community and interpersonal relationships and try and sort of analyze them logically. And I think on this bigger question, the metaphysics behind it, the same applies. I don't think you can abstract ethics from some kind of bigger framework. Where I think things do get interesting, and where if I were on Peter's side of the table, I would at least be sort of scratching my head slightly, I think, is that if one is not careful, you do end up with, I forget which philosopher sort of coined this phrase, you end up with a sort of extravagant Platonism, that you have this realm, wherever you put it, in which we have moral values and duties, mathematical objects, other abstract objects, and it sort of grows and grows and grows and is full of these things, rather than for Christian theism to go, well, okay, we actually only have one sort of metaphysical object, as it were, which is God, and those things are grounded in the mind of God. Not least that's helpful because moral commandments do follow, but moral duties do follow between people. And so rather than thou shalt not murder floating around abstractly out in the void, doing nothing until human beings have evolved to such a point that suddenly it applies to them in the same way as the law of gravity applies to them, actually we have a divine person. And duties and so forth follow between persons. I think there's something around that that intrigues me.
Why does that not follow for you, that these duties and moral values should be grounded in something, I suppose, beyond ourselves in the form of God, ultimately?
Well, to answer that, we would have to get back to questions about whether there are reasons for us to believe that God exists. And especially as we're talking about morality and the claim that morality is grounded in the existence of God or the will of God, I do think you have to look at the world around you and you have to say there is an immense amount of suffering that goes on, which I don't believe an all-powerful, omniscient, and good, morally good being would permit. Because this is not simply suffering that occurs to those who do bad things. It's not even if you were to believe what I think is a repellent doctrine of original sin, that all humans have sinned because Adam and Eve sinned, and therefore it's okay for us to be punished. Because even if you accept that, non-human animals not being descended from Adam would not have original sin, and yet it's clear that they suffer, and not only at the hands of humans, they suffer because I come from Australia, you know, there's seasonal droughts. Out there in the arid centre of Australia, there are droughts, and many kangaroos and other animals will slowly die of thirst, a miserable death. I cannot for the life of me see why a good God would permit that. So
really, the fact that you can't place these moral duties and values in the framework of God is because there are other aspects of God that you just find can't bring you.
That's certainly a major reason for me. I mean, Andrew said objected to extravagant Platonism and seemed to imply that belief in a God is somehow less extravagant. We could have a debate about, you know, what creates more metaphysical extravagance, and that would be another issue that we could raise. And also, I still haven't really heard Andrew's answer to the question of whether God is simply, you know, whether the things that God says are good, they could have been different or not. I haven't. I know he said that something part of the idea of goodness, but then.
Well, let's open send this back to you, Andy, because
absolutely.
I think there's a couple of questions there.
There are
this challenge over whether you can resolve Euthyphro's dilemma and whether God actually does command the good and so on, but also the problem of suffering. You know, Peter says I'm not God's not even on the table as long as the world we're in is the world that God has created, because I can't reconcile that with a God of love as you seem to be able to.
There's a lot of good things in there, but let's take that latter one, Peter, because I think that's a hugely, you know, significant question. And of course, you know, as a philosopher who is, you know, no slouch, you'll be aware that there's a whole branch of philosophy that deals with that from a range of perspectives, which is the whole branch of philosophy and theology known as theodicy. So I think it'd be interesting to do some digging into that if one's going to use that as an argument. What I find interesting is right from the word go, that actually that brings a whole moral dimension to bear on the world that we live in. Because, of course, our instinctive reaction hopefully our instinctive reaction, whether it's kangaroos dying of thirst in the centre of Australia, or whether it's, you know, a hurricane or whatever causing some kind of natural disaster, is we don't just view it coldly and dispassionately. We actually bring the ought to bear. It ought not to be like that. The world ought to be different. And that oughtness, as somebody once described, is a bit like the bubble on the wallpaper. You know, you wallpaper a room and there's a bubble over here and you push it down and it pops up over here. We can't seem to avoid making those kind of value judgments. Now, if that was all there was to say, then I think, you know, if the Christian story was simply God is good and has created this world and, hey, isn't it wonderful, then I think we'd have every duty to come along and go, well, hang on just a moment. But of course, that's neither the beginning of the story nor the end of the story. The beginning of the story is that something has gone wrong with creation. With all due respect, Peter, you slightly mischaracterize the Christian doctrine of original sin, which is not the reason the world is in the state it's in is because God goes, ha, because of Adam and Eve, I'm just going to, you know, kill those kangaroos, unless that's that's the AV, the Australian version.
Rather than that's actually
fundamentally twisted and broken creation, both our relationship with God and creation itself.
But if God is all powerful, why can't he fix it?
I'm so glad you asked that question. Before I get to that, I also point out, interestingly, I don't know if you're aware of, one of our most iconoclastic atheist philosophers here in the UK is John Gray, formerly London School of Economics. And John, either in his book Heresies or in Straw Dogs, I always forget which one this is found in, talks about the doctrine of original sin and the fall, and says, much as I disagree with much that Christians have said, he said, that's actually the one thing I think Christianity has got right. Just look around you. Human beings are a badly broken animal. Now, your question about why does God allow it? Well, if God had simply sat there in heaven and done nothing about it, then I think we would be able to raise that very charge of going, well, it's all right for you. You're sitting up there in heaven. Life is pretty miserable down here. But of course, the whole of the Christian story is what God has and is doing about it in and through the cross and through Jesus. And whether or whatever you make of Jesus of Nazareth, certainly the heart of the Christian story, you have the ability to go, the one thing you cannot pin on the God of the Bible is this is not a God who knows something, who knows nothing about suffering and injustice. And interestingly, Justin, that brings us full circle. Because one of the things I would also want to bring to the table as a Christian about human value and dignity is that value is also conferred by what somebody is prepared to pay. And in the God of the Bible, and then the cross, and in Jesus, you have God making a tremendous statement about the value of human beings, such that he will be willing to go through that in the person of Jesus.
This is still very strange, right? Because if we believe that Jesus was God's son and God sent him to earth.
I most certainly do.
Right, so that happened about 2,000 years ago, right? And yet the world still has all of this suffering. So here's this supposedly all-powerful being who created the universe and everything, and who doesn't like the suffering that goes on, and who tried to do something about it 2,000 years ago, and yet the suffering is still going on. Doesn't seem to be really better. So it seems like he's a bungler. He made a bad mistake in thinking that sending his son to be crucified would somehow fix all the suffering in the world, and it plainly hasn't.
Well, actually, if I was going to be wonderfully sort of cheeky, I'd go, actually, Steven Pinker was sitting in that chair not long ago, who says the world has got increasingly better in the last
couple of
years.
I agree with Steven Pinker about that, but not as much better as it ought to have got if we had an all-powerful good being.
But here's the interesting thing. That answer, I think... That question, of course, is raised right from the very, very beginning, because the first Christians who went out across the Roman world and began preaching the Christian message and saw Christians go from being 0.0008% of the Roman Empire to 51.2% in 312 years, they knew full well that Christians were thrown to the lions, that earthquakes happened, that disease happened, yet they still believed that God had come in the person of Jesus, risen from the dead, that that was the death blow struck to evil, and that was the beginning of God's new creation and putting
so
the world back
had
together
a very
again.
Strange false belief, I think.
Well, interesting you say false belief. One of the things that intrigues me about the suffering question as well, and to go, this is a rabbit trail of its own, but I think it's a fascinating one. One of the things that began to intrigue me as I taught, you know, university level courses on the problem of evil was it's a peculiarly Western question. It's not that doesn't make it an irrelevant question, but when I would travel to the East, and I have many, many friends who are living in situations where they've experienced terrific suffering, persecution. I've met people who have lost their homes, their families, who've been tortured in prison for their Christian faith or experienced other things. These questions don't arise. It was pointed out after the tsunami, the Asian tsunami. It was Western newspapers that were running editorials with, where is God? That question wasn't being asked.
Well, because they don't really believe in that God that we believe, the
personal
God that...
Well, Christians caught up in it would have been... Muslims would have done. Those questions were not being asked. And that just tells me something. I think it tells me that whilst this is not an unimportant question, we forget that we all ask our question from a position. We approach our philosophy from a position, and we're approaching this as Westerners. And I think there is something when you draw that lens back. Similarly, historically, to go, if the problem of evil was such a spectacular argument against belief in a good God, then I think, as the Oxford professor C.S. Lewis famously asked, how did that belief ever arise in the first place? Men are crazy, but not as crazy as that. So I think we need to wrestle with the question, but I think it's actually a question for both atheists and for Christians to wrestle with, because it gets us of the issue.
I don't see why it's a question for atheists. I mean, we understand the world as having evolved from very simple beings that were not conscious. There's no plan to the world for an atheist evolutionary viewpoint. It's just happened through random mutations. And unfortunately, you know, if you like, it's indifferent as to whether it causes suffering or not in terms of how things evolve. So I don't see why it's at all a problem for atheists that there is all
this. Well, let me explain why. I think if atheists were simply content to leave it there, that would be one thing. But the fact that when natural disasters happen, we find atheists quick to use moral language.
Why should? Of course, and I've never denied that we should use moral language.
So where does the oughtness come from? It's just evolution doing her thing or his thing.
No,
or
it's
their
not
thing.
At all. Not at all. That would be the naturalistic fallacy, and that's why I said to Justin before, I'm not a naturalist. No, it's that we can understand as rational beings that gratuitous suffering is a bad thing, and that for beings to experience joy and pleasure and happiness is a good thing. And moral language follows from that. So I don't think there's any problem for an atheist in using moral language. I think that problem, the problem of suffering, is therefore uniquely a problem for those who believe in a God who has these three attributes of omniscience, omnipotence, and omnibenevolence, or goodness.
Well, let me bring it back to the issue of it not being a problem, Peter. You wrote, sorry, I was just digging on my iPad because I thought I actually wanted to read you something. You said, far from justifying principles that are shown to be natural, a biological explanation can be a way of debunking what seem to be eternal moral axioms. When a widely accepted moral principle is given a convincing biological explanation, we need to think again about whether we should accept the principle.
That's right. And so debunking explanation. That means we don't support the value that we might hold because it helped us to survive and reproduce. The fact that a value helped us to survive and reproduce doesn't prove that it's false, but should lead us to a certain skepticism.
Exactly. And in the same way that our instinctive reaction to when we see suffering in nature is, oh, that's a terrible thing, we could debunk the same thing. In fact, A.J. Ayers, I think it was, who famously said, the debunker should be forced to wave his own debunking sword over his own cherished beliefs in public. And so I think, actually, evolution, when you apply it that way, becomes a universal asset.
I don't think it does, and I've argued, in fact, in a
book
called The Point of View of the Universe, that the idea of universal benevolence, the idea that, as the late 19th century utilitarian philosopher Henry Sidgwick said, from the point of view of the universe, the interests of each being count the same if they're similar sorts of interests. That's something that you cannot explain in evolutionary terms, why we should hold that belief, because it actually would be more advantageous to our survival and reproduction if we said, no, beings who are not any kin of mine or not in a reciprocal relationship with me, their interests don't count. And of course, a lot of people do actually act on that, and it's not surprising given that we are evolved beings who descended from ancestors who succeeded in reproducing. It's not surprising that we should have tendencies to act on that. And when you referred to the idea of human nature as being broken, I think it's simply something that we can understand in evolutionary terms, why we do not act with universal benevolence to all. But as rational beings, I think we can see that that would be the right way to act. So I think that that's an ethical principle that is not debunked by evolutionary explanations.
I'm less so sure. I'm less sure. I mean, it was interesting. You mentioned there some of the in your last commentary on evolution. There, one of my favourite. You mentioned Tom Nagel earlier. One of my other favourite iconoclastic philosophers is an Australian. Well, was an Australian, the late David Stove. Mm-hmm. Who wrote a wonderful book called Darwinian Fairy Tales, I think really doing a fantastic job of debunking attempts to use evolution to get us any form of ethics. But although he has a nice little language he uses there, that we continually, people who want to wed their belief system purely in evolution, continually keep applying patches to the theory to try and come up with why human beings are altruistic. Because, of course, human beings seem to use altruism everywhere. On the other hand, you're criticizing human beings for not displaying, care sort of equally to all. But actually, we have invented all kinds of ways of helping people who are not biologically connected to us. And if you're an evolutionary sociobiologist like E.O. Wilson, that causes you a tremendous headache. But one thing I think is interesting I would like to pick you up on is that something a comment I made earlier about ethics and morality existing within relationships. And I think, of course, particularly where they exist is within familial relationships. So I think you've argued in several places that in theory there's no necessarily good moral reason for if there's a house on fire and you could rescue your biological offspring or rescue someone else's offspring, why you should pick your own child. But you admitted elsewhere that in the case of your daughters, if there was a house fire, you'd probably grab those who were your kith and kin and not the others.
I'm sure I would, because I'm also a human who is descended from others who've evolved to have these strong
feelings.
My
question is,
I'm not
necessarily convinced that's a bad thing, because I think one of the things we've been dancing around a little bit in this whole discussion is, of course, if you look at classical ethical theory, if you take this back to Aristotle and the such like, we get into the issues that ethics is about character. In fact, ethics comes from the Greek word ethos, that means character. And for Aristotle and many others, the key question will be, how do we build citizens and human beings who have a certain kind of character? Both your earlier preference-based utilitarianism and now the hedonistic utilitarianism that you would say is your framework, and the idea of promoting good and avoiding pain. I was sitting there thinking about this last night while feeding my son banana and peanut butter. We believe in good nutrition.
Very good, healthy meal for your son.
Yes, he rejected the salad, so this was the only thing we could get Christopher to eat at 6:30 last night. But it suddenly occurred to me that in the context of that of my parenting relationship with my 3-year-old, sure, avoiding pain is certainly part of it. I shouldn't clobber him around the head with a frying pan when he puts his leg breaks on the floor. But on the other hand, that is a remarkably thin ethic, because most of my parenting relationship with my son and my daughter is around, how do I form them to be persons of character? How do I shape them and mold them, more so at first than as they get older, to the reins less tightly? Because success looks like, for me, not a child who's happy. Well, that's a good plan B or C, but a child who is good, a child who's noble, a child who is brave, a child who is self-sacrificial, all that long list, which would come under what the ancients called character. And I think one of my slight concerns with this whole kind of discussion is that we abstract ethics into this sort of zero-sum game of, you know, adding up happiness points versus negative points, and the idea we should all be treating everybody absolutely equally, irrespective of our relationship to them, ignores those kind of familial settings, ignores the duty that we have to siblings, to spouses to whom we've made commitments, and so on and so forth. Ethics can't be abstracted from close relationships and from character.
Would you agree with that, Peter?
I agree with a great deal of that, yes. I certainly think we ought to bring up our children to have a good character, a good moral character in various ways, and not just to be happy in themselves, if you like, selfishly happy. And I think it's also possible that, in fact, bringing them up to have a good moral character is a good way for them to be happy and fulfilled, and there's some good psychological research that shows that. But I think the broader utilitarian framework that I hold can accommodate that because we don't simply want to try to bring up everyone to be completely impartial between their own children and those of the children of strangers, because in fact we know that in order to have children who have good lives and are psychologically well adjusted, bringing them up in a close and loving family relationship is the best way to do it. And, of course, there have been various experiments over the centuries to try to bring them up in a more abstract or communal way, and it seems they don't work particularly well, so they don't suit our nature. So as utilitarians, we can actually encourage people to be the kind of loving father that you obviously are and to try to bring up your child to have a good moral character. And I think that's compatible with the broader utilitarian ideal of wanting people to be well-adjusted and live in a good society.
I often come across people, though, who are worried philosophically about where a strict utilitarian ethic leads you. And so, for instance, I know some of the things that people have objected to in terms of the points you've made on this, I think you once wrote regarding a utilitarian argument for euthanizing disabled children, when the death of a disabled infant will lead to the birth of another infant with better prospects of a happy life, the total amount of happiness will be greater if the disabled infant is killed. The loss of happy life for the first infant is outweighed by the gain of a happier life for the second. And I think a lot of people look at that and think, well, that makes sense in a utilitarian framework, but it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like we should be killing off a child A because child B that would replace it would be happier potentially.
Right. The statement that you read doesn't say that we should kill off that child. It says the total amount of happiness would be greater, which is not in itself a value judgment.
Okay.
And it's in the context of a discussion about two different views, both utilitarian. One of which is a view that says to maximize the total amount, including the happiness that would be experienced by beings who we would bring into the world who would not otherwise exist, as against what I call, and you're quoting from Practical Ethics, one of my books, what I call the prior existence view, which says we ought to focus on maximizing the happiness of those beings who either already do exist or will exist independently of anything we do. So in saying the total happiness will be greater, I'm not necessarily saying that's the right thing to do.
Okay.
I'm saying that's what is implied by this total view of happiness, and I'm leaving it open at least at that point as to whether that's the view we ought to follow or the one that is concerned with.
I mean, are you in a sense though open to that idea that people
I'm open to the idea that yes, it's in considering whether it's better on the whole that a being without good prospects of a happy or worthwhile life, whether that being should live or die, in considering that question, it's relevant to ask, if this child dies, will there be another child who is brought into existence and who would have a good and rich and fulfilling life and who would not have existed if that other child had not died?
I think this is where often the disability advocates have a problem, though, isn't it, Peter, in as much as they say, well, who are you to judge the value of the life of the disabled child over against a able-bodied child? Because it's not that's perhaps too simplistic a way of understanding the thing.
Well, of course, there are many factors, and it would depend. I mean, it's not simply that, you know, of any disability that this is true, but there might be some of whom I think you clearly could say a child who has a condition, for example, called epidermolysis bullosa, which is one where the skin keeps breaking and it's impossible really to to stop the skin breaking and wounds developing and infections developing. And if you try and bandage it and then you change the bandages, you just pull off more skin. And in very severe cases, that's a life of misery and suffering, and the child will die predictably within months or a couple of years. So I think it is possible to say objectively, really, that that is not a good life, that it's better if that child were never born, or if they are born, that they die swiftly and humanely rather than they we try to prolong their life as long as we can.
And Andy Bannister will respond to Peter's utilitarian approach to disability rights shortly. It's time for our final break. You're listening to the sixth and final episode of the Big Conversation series here on Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, as atheist moral philosopher Peter Singer debates Christian thinker Andy Bannister on whether we need God to be good. You can watch all of our Big Conversations in glorious video at thebigconversation.show, where you can also sign up for our newsletter and get show updates and bonus content.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content, and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
Welcome back to Unbelievable, the show that brings you conversations that matter. And if you stay tuned after the show here on Premier Christian Radio at 4 p.m. on The Profile, Sam Hales will be sitting down with David Stroud, leader of Christchurch London, ahead of their Everything conference on the 17th of November. They'll be talking about David's vision for spiritual, social and cultural renewal in the city. And you can find that conversation on The Profile podcast from Premier as well. Well, next week on Unbelievable, I'm welcoming back atheist Michael Roos to the show. He was one of our conversation partners on The Big Conversation in this season. This time, though, he's coming on to debate Darwinism, Christianity and war with my Christian guest, Professor Nigel Bigger of Oxford University. Well, as the world commemorates the centenary of the end of World War One in a week's time, they'll be debating pacifism, Christianity, nature, red in tooth and claw and just war theory on the show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
But for now, it's time for the final part of our sixth and final episode of The Big Conversation, bringing you engaging interactions between believers and non-believers. Do check out the full schedule of episodes in this special series at thebigconversation.show. We're also uploading related blogs there. In fact, the latest one is written by Esther O'Reilly, titled What's Stopping Jordan Peterson from Rejecting the Resurrection? Reflecting back on the very first Big Conversation that we had in this series, as well as a number of other conversations we've had on the show since then. No time for your feedback today, but do send your thoughts about today's show as usual to unbelievable@premier.org.uk or via our social media channels at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. And do make sure to check out the video of today's show at thebigconversation.show. Feel free to leave a comment on the YouTube video there. Time for the final part then of our debate on evolution, morality and being human, asking, do we need God to be good? Peter Singer has just set out his utilitarian case for ending the lives of children born with severe disabilities. Let's see what Andy Bannister has to say in response. Where do you stand on this then? Because I take it that for you, the principle of human value is broader than simply whether that child will or won't experience a certain degree of pain in their life.
There's a whole number of things going on here. I mean, I think, firstly, I think we need to be very careful. I mean, I don't like wielding slippery slope arguments, but there is a slight one here of going how far before we have an issue. And I mean, so to, you know, use an analogy, Justin, if you and I were tasked with, you know, demolishing a building near here in London, and you were my supervisor, and you said to me, like, before we press the button, Andy, your job is to go through this building, all, you know, sort of 14 stories of it, and just check there's no human beings in there. And I come back and I report to you, oh, well, I don't think there's any human beings. You can press the button. Would you press the button and demolish the building based on my, I think there might not be anybody in there? And I think I get a bit worried when we say, well, we think the quality of life is such that here's a clear-cut case. That's problem number one. Secondly, I think the other problem with utilitarianism, I mean, it's been subject, there's a reason it's not believed particularly widely, and I think it's subject to two pretty critical critiques. First is it does tend to absorb the individual into the whole when you start trying to add up or, you know, and do sort of a, you know, add up the happiness and subtract the suffering. that becomes a huge problem. For example, we might enslave you and put you to work for Peter, and Peter's happiness goes up by a vast amount and your happiness goes down by a little bit less. But I think most people would still say we'd wronged you by using you to benefit Peter, even if we could somehow zero sum it. And I think the other issue as well that often gets missed in utilitarian discussions is, of course, how we measure net happiness anyway. I mean, do we add it up? Do we average it? If we have 10 people with 10 units of happiness each, well, obviously the average amount of happiness per person is 10. Or if we have one person over here, perhaps a utility monster, as Robert Nozick, the great American philosopher, might put it, one person over here with 91 units and everyone else has one, well, the average is still the same. And I think all of those sorts of experiments show that I think once you start trying to weigh happiness or subtract suffering or all these other kind of things, you hit a problem. And so I think that's why I think the founders, those who formed the UDHR, did an absolutely brilliant job. It's not perfect. There are discussions to be had. But grounding it in nature, grounding it in dignity, grounding it in what, as philosophers, we'd call ontology, is a much more secure founding than subjective sort of statements of, well, so, I think that person's life is...
So I mean, you obviously ground, in a sense, the value of a life in the ability of that life to have preferences, to be able to reason, the happiness and so on that is potential within that life. Andy, it appears, is saying, well, those are measures, but they may mislead us, and in fact there's something intrinsically about a human life, even if it might be one which on your scale doesn't necessarily seem to have prospects of happiness and so on. What's the problem you have with Andy's sort of...
Well, there are a number of problems, but one is, why would you think that this intrinsic value, again, exists only in members of the species Homo sapien? Right? When it comes to dogs, for example, if you have a dog who is getting old and ill or has some condition that the vet says the dog will not recover from, we all think that at some point we ought to make the decision to take the dog to the vet and say, look, I think enough is enough. Would you please humanely end the life of my dog? And that's a tough decision to make, and people will agonize over whether they've made it at the right time or not. But we recognize that it's better to make that decision than to allow the dog to continue to suffer, at least at some point. Now, if that's true of dogs, why is it not true of infants with conditions where they are also going to suffer considerably, and where we have to make a decision one way or the other? I mean, it's not as if you can say, as you could in the case of the 14-story building, you could just say, look, let's not demolish this building now. I'm not sure. Let's get somebody more careful than Andrew is to go through the building and really make sure that there is nobody in that building. But in the case of a suffering child or a suffering dog, to just say, well, let's not take the dog to the vet is effectively to make a decision that at least, today the dog will suffer for another day, even if we change our mind tomorrow. And the same would be true, of course, of a child in that situation.
So that, I think that is a good question, Andy. Mm. Why do we treat our animals different to the way we tend to treat humans? Are we simply talking about the same kind of thing? It's just about minimizing suffering at the end of the day.
I think no, in a nutshell. I think we have a duty of care to animals, very, very, very much so. And I think for me that flows out of who we are as human beings. So, Peter's story of the dog, I mean, I identify with very much. I can remember we had to have our first cat put down because he was very, very ill. And that was an emotional moment. That cat was very dear to us. But it was also a cat, and my relationship with the cat was different to my relationship to my wife. But I think that flows out, thankfully. But I think that flows out of who we are as human beings. And look, one thing I think we've been dancing around a bit for me in some of this discussion, we've mentioned his name a couple of times, Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, famously said, in terms of explaining anything, given the what the cause of anything is, there are four causes, whether we're talking about a table or a human being. There's the formal cause, that's all metaphysical, we'll just put that to one side. There's the efficient cause, so in your case, what you're made out of. The material cause, what you're made out of. The efficient cause, how you came to be, birds and bees and those kind of things. If you need to know, Justin, Peter and I will talk to you afterwards.
Thank you.
But then the most interesting one that really, I think, comes to bear on this conversation is that what he called the final cause, what something is made for. And I think this is interesting because, as Michael Sandel, the famous, Harvard ethicist, put it, he said, we can't really have these conversations without actually ascertaining what a good life looks like and actually what the good society looks like. And it was interesting. I mean, the book that Peter's famous for many books. You put people like me, who've just published three, into the shade. But I mean, Practical Ethics. I read that again yesterday, because it's been some years since I read it. And it occurred to me, reading it, it was a wonderful book, but there was also, for me, a gaping hole. And the gaping hole, perhaps, again, illustrated the thought experiment. If I got back to Dundee this evening, and on the way back I visited the airport bookstore, and I burst into my house in Dundee and say to my wife, honey, we're going to the beach on the weekend because I've just bought Practical Canoeing. And it's a book that tells you how to make canoes and sail canoes, and I drag the family off there, even though it's raining in Scotland. It never rains in Scotland. And I load the kids and the wife into the canoe, and off we go paddling out to the North Sea, and I explain all the wonderful features of my canoe, how practical it is. And at some point, my wife will probably look at me and say, well, Andy, honey, where are we going? What's the destination? I'll go, well, don't ask foolish questions. Can you not see how wonderfully constructed the canoe is? And I confess that was slightly my takeaway from Practical Ethics and some of this discussion, that I think unless we know where we're going,
You do assume, and Aristotle certainly assumed, that there is a final purpose, right? That the universe somehow has a purpose. And that, I think, is an unscientific view. I think if we understand a scientific view of the universe, it exists. Life has evolved on this planet. It has evolved to the point at which there are sentient beings, beings with consciousness, beings also capable of making choices. But there is no ultimate end of the universe, and it's a mistake to ask that question about life in general. We can ask, what are your purposes and what are my purposes, because we're purposive beings, and we can decide, as we've been saying, what are good things to do and what are bad things to do. But I think there isn't a final end in terms of humans somehow all having some end which gives them some special moral status.
So how do we decide then? How do we decide on what we're here for?
Well, we're not here for anything as such, well, except the ends that we ourselves choose to have.
I suppose, though, then how do we decide between the person who decides that their best end is to live selfishly, get the most amount of money and play golf until they die, and the person who gives their life away for the poor and the needy and so on? Which is there a way of deciding which of those is the way we should live, or is it simply ultimately down to
the way we should live, as an ethical question, is not only to think of ourselves but also to think of others, and helping the poor is obviously an important part of.
But that sounds like there is a purpose then.
It's not a purpose. It's that some things, put it this way, I would say that some states of the universe would be better than other states of the universe. So a state of the universe in which everybody suffers agony, every sentient being is in agony for its entire existence and then dies, is a worse state of the universe than a state of the universe in which every sentient being is enjoying its life for its entire existence and then dies. But that doesn't mean that the universe has an ultimate purpose, or that it's somehow the purpose of the universe that beings should not suffer and should enjoy their lives.
I think we're back to the bubble on the wallpaper again, that I think what's interesting, I mean, Justin, I think you asked Peter a good question here. I think it depends what you decide the goal is. The moment you say that something is better, for example, that becomes the question, better to as to what? For example, if you could see a pile of wood in my backyard, and I say I spent all day making that pile, it was better than my last three attempts, well, it's probably important to know, was I trying to build a bonfire for Guy Fawkes Day, and I want something that I can put a guy on top of and my kids have a bonfire party, or if I'm trying to build my kids a Wendy house, it's probably important to know what better is with regard to...
Sure, because
to,
you're a purposive being, and you have purposes, and your judgment of what
a good wood pile
would be affected by.
Exactly, that. But right. I think the fact that the problem is, though, Peter, I think in this discussion, we're not just weighing purposes within someone's purposes. If you decide the purpose of your life is to help as many of the poor as possible, then we can weigh your decisions in the light of that and decide, okay, is Peter living his life in such a way as to bring about the nearest to that possible goal? Or if someone decides they're going to spend their life playing soccer, we can do the same thing. How are they achieving that goal? But in terms of weighing two people's choices, and actually I thought you came close to this at the end of Practical Ethics, where you sort of use the stamp collecting example of sort of saying, well, I mean, probably ultimately someone who chooses stamp collecting or playing football versus somebody who chooses something that perhaps in your mind would be more noble. We can't really weigh between them. You really do have to come down to preferences.
No, I don't say that. I do think if we're making an ethical question, we can weigh between them. And the choice that leads to more beings enjoying their lives and suffering less is the better choice, and that's probably not going to be stamped.
But then I would put the question back to you, better according to
well,
to
we,
what?
We've been to this through this, right?
I don't think we have.
Better according to those values which, as rational beings, we can understand are the correct values. As we said before, I do think that there are values that exist that are objective in the world, and we can see what those values are. There's room for dispute. There's room for disagreement about them. But as we said before, I think there are correct decisions and incorrect decisions in terms of what is what really is a good value and what isn't. And that's how we ought to judge the, as I said, if we're thinking ethically, that's how we ought to judge the various life choices that
would
we can
you
make.
Would you say, and I confess this is a slightly leading question, would you say that the perhaps the test of a practical ethic is how it plays out in the real world, and we take that out of the classroom and we actually try and live
Absolutely,
it out?
Absolutely, yes.
And then conversely, how we live our lives here reflects our ethic. The reason I ask that is Justin raised, obviously some of the things that you have said have caused controversy, and we've talked about that. But one of the things that intrigued me the most as I read a bit more around you, I confess I knew, two of your books in particular, but not a lot of your background, was, and forgive me for raising this example, I don't mean to cause any offence, but was the story of what happened with your mother a few years ago, when your mother contracted Alzheimer's and eventually sort of lost that sort of sense of who she was. And as I understand it, had sort of made some requests about not sort of, the way she wanted to be treated towards the end of her life. But you and your sister, I understand, paid...
No, that's not true that we didn't follow her
okay.
request.
But my point being is that you and your...
Except insofar as that
okay.
it was not would not have been legal for us to
Fine.
Or for any
okay.
doctor to carry
sure.
out euthanasia.
But my point being is towards the end of her life, she is, by the definitions that you've used for disability, is effectively moving into non-personhood. But you spent a lot of money on her personal care. And I remember there was an interview with a journalist that really struck me where you said, and I quote, "I guess things are different when it comes to her."
I think that was a somewhat misleading statement. I mean, I felt them. Certainly, obviously, you feel them strongly, as you felt the decision to put down your cat very differently from, I don't know whether you eat animals at all, but whether, you might have felt the decision to kill a pig or a cow. Yes, you feel them differently. But
I'm just struck then by that. I just wonder when you take that sort of cold, almost sort of Spock-like utilitarian ethic, and it becomes a very close, very personal, very difficult, appreciate it would be a difficult family situation, that actually that's when the tension is felt, and that actually there's almost that realization of maybe this ethic doesn't quite work in the real world, and therefore that real world, very personal, very difficult, very complex situation, as one of your reviewers pointed out, did it take that for after 30 years of teaching ethics for you to perhaps just realize that maybe some of these ethical decisions are slightly more complicated than
No, I think I knew that they were complicated, and of course we don't control all the factors in the world, and as I said, one of the factors was that euthanasia in Australia was not legal for somebody in my mother's situation. There's no doubt that my mother had said that she would not want to live in the state that she got to, and that if euthanasia had been legal, she would have no doubt previously signed a request. She was a paid-up member of the Voluntary Euthanasia Society of Victoria, my sister and I would have asked the doctor to carry out her request. But given that it was not legal, we did not want to put ourselves in the situation of breaking the law, we did want to make her comfortable. We wanted to not to allow her to suffer.
Even though maybe the greater good, you could have taken a
it's
certain
It's possible that
you could
the
have
money,
taken a certain action.
Yes, the money that we spent on her could have done more yeah. good elsewhere.
I was thinking if you could have helped her out the door and faced the legal consequences. And
when it came to a point at which she developed a pneumonia, and then we talked to the doctor, and the doctor was prepared to not treat that so that she didn't live as long as she might have lived if she had been treated with all possible medical technologies to keep her alive as long as possible. So it's not that we didn't take any steps to say, this is not a life that's really worth living anymore.
I mean, all of this simply brings me back to the point that you are, like all of us, trying to do the best that you can in the world that we live in.
And that
in a sense you are guided by the principles, as far as you can be, that you've espoused in your books and in the philosophy you've developed, Peter. What's been fascinating to me in this conversation is that as an atheist, you've said there is a way we should be living. There is an objective realm of moral values and duties that we are all beholden to. So we aren't simply choosing, whether to spend our life in idleness or whether to help the poor. There is actually one of those options is a better option, is the option we
yes,
should be pursuing
sure.
in life. Even though that's developed in a purely, in a sense, random, purposeless universe, there is nonetheless this purposeful aspect to the universe that's baked in at some level to it?
Well, it's not a purpose, but if you like, you could say there are values that exist independently of our choosing them. I'd be prepared to say that, just as you might say the mathematical theorems might be true or false in the universe.
I know that you have a problem with saying that God grounds those types of values and duties. Obviously, Andy believes that is a good explanation for where those come from and why we should abide by them. But do they strike you as mysterious that this realm exists in and that we happen as an evolved species to have grasped onto that and we have evolved in tandem with this other moral realm that exists? And for me, is there not something about that that might suggest there's something going on? There's evolution has taken us to the point where we can adopt this moral framework, and this is the reason that we're here, if you like, almost.
Well, evolution has brought us to the point where we're capable of reasoning and of thinking, reflecting on the nature of the universe. But when you said that's why we're here, no, I don't see any reason for thinking that this is why we're here or that we're here for some purpose. And again, I would go back to the point I made. It seems to me very hard to believe that a God, particularly a God like the Christian God, would have gone through this incredibly long evolutionary path with the immense amount of suffering that process has brought in its wake in order to achieve this state where we can grasp what values are good and what are bad.
As we start to wrap this up, I wonder if you've got any comments on the fact that Peter does obviously believe there's a realm of objective moral values and duties that we're beholden to, but obviously feels that is just something that we happen to have come to a point in our unpurposed evolution that we're able to access with
reason.
Yeah,
I mean, I think in a sense, Justin, the question you put to Peter was a good one, because I think the conundrum that poses is exactly as you described it, to go, well, firstly, of course, where is it located? And then, you know, what is it about suddenly the point we've arrived at an evolutionary scale, if that's the way we've got here, if evolution is the only game in town, as Professor Dawkins once memorably put it, suddenly, one of our hominid ancestors woke up to find that not just merely the law of gravitation, but the law of, you know, loving thy neighbour suddenly applied. I mean, was their reaction, wonderful, I'm now a moral agent, or oh, bummer, I now can't, you know, club the primate next door over the head with my club. So I think that's an interesting one. And I think, you know, one of the things I'm always very interested to explore, and we don't have time to go into this now really, but I think all of these discussions raise this, right, is to go, I always want to believe, hold to the virtue of epistemic humility, of realizing Christians do not have all of the answers tied up with a neat bow on the top, and anyone who tells you they do isn't thinking, nor do atheists have all of the neat answers tied up with a bow on the top. What we do is we place the evidence on the table and ask which best explains the range of evidence that we have, even if there are things that we wrestle with and pick up and find where that piece goes. And I actually think, you know, ultimately the reason I'm a Christian is that I think the fact that there is this, you know, objective morality outside of ours isn't the only piece of evidence on the table, but it's one that, were I an atheist, I'd find very hard to fit into there. And then I bring that into play with other things. For example, it's interesting that you quoted Thomas Nagel to this end. Tom is an atheist philosopher, for listeners who haven't come across him, wrote a really kind of very heavily commented on book recently called Mind and Cosmos, Why the Naturalistic View of Reality is Almost Certainly Wrong. And he puts forward moral values that Peter's pointed to. He also puts forward consciousness, which is interesting. And also in interviews as well, I believe I've seen, talks about freedom. And you see, this is an interesting one, and this is one of the conversations that I wish we had time to pursue, actually, because underpinning all of this is this assumption that we can be free to choose morally. But of course, if we are just governed, not just by the forces of evolution, but by the blind forces of physics and chemistry and biology and so forth, are we actually free? And again, I wish I had time to explore this, Peter. When I read your account in that latest edition of Practical Ethics about what happened to you in Germany, one of the little marginal notes I wrote down is actually Peter's ultimate value freedom that you believe in, you know, because you made this impassioned, you know, sort of plea there for academic freedom, but maybe academic freedom actually doesn't serve the common good. And of course, unless we're free, we can't choose what we do with this realm of objective morality and so forth. So freedom and consciousness and all these other things all go into the pile to discuss on the table.
We probably don't have time to dig into it.
It's a whole show
point,
there, isn't it?
But no. Freedom, consciousness, I mean, there are a range of things which seem incredibly important to us and which some people, including Andy, feel don't fit well with a naturalistic understanding of the universe. I mean, do you just find that the problem is God isn't a satisfactory explanation for any of those either, so you'll stick with your atheism even if there are some
That would be the short answer, yes. I think God is a less satisfactory explanation than the kinds of accounts that I've given. But I, you know, I do agree with your view that neither of us, or anyone in the world for that matter, has everything neatly wrapped up with a pink bow, and there are interesting philosophical questions to pursue, and that's a good thing as a professional philosopher. I'm glad that, you know, we haven't just said, finis, okay, we'll all go and do something else. So certainly there are good questions to continue to discuss, and I think Tom Nagle's interesting book, Mind and Cosmos, does discuss those questions, and there are things that perhaps don't fit with when Tom says with a naturalistic view of the universe. He's not saying that the alternative to that is necessarily a theistic view of the universe. He's rather saying, perhaps as I've been saying, that there may be a realm of reality that is not open to scientific exploration. And this realm of reality might be things like ethics, ethical values, and might be things like the nature of consciousness and Tom thinks freedom. I'm not sure that I agree with him in terms of freedom as opposed to determinism, but it's possible. And there are things that we don't understand fully from that respect. So, those remain open questions as to how we can best understand them.
I'm intrigued that one of my, as a Christian, you wouldn't be surprised, you know, one of my sort of philosophical heroes is C.S. Lewis. And just to be cheeky, of course, it's interesting that, you know, Lewis was an atheist for 30 years of his life before just beginning the journey that led him back to Christianity. Well, of course, the first step on that journey was from atheism to idealism, which is the idea that basically material physical things are not the only things that exist. There's also this realm of abstract whatevers. And then he slid from idealism to deism, deism to theism, and theism to Christianity. But he said the biggest jump was that one from atheism to idealism. So I'm going to cheekily say, you're halfway there, Peter. Come on home.
Well, I noticed that you used the verb slid, which is not necessarily a desirable form of progress. So I'll stop sliding, I think, at that point.
Well played.
it's been fabulous having you both on the program today. Perhaps just as we end, we could just have your short answer to the final question that I'm going to put to you both, which simply is, tell us from your point of view, Peter, where do we find the value of a human being? Where is that? What is it exactly? What's it grounded in for you?
To me, the value of a human being, as with the value of many non-human animals, consists in our capacity to have conscious experiences, to have minds, to suffer, to enjoy things, and to find things favorable to us and find things unfavorable.
And finally, Andy, where do you believe the value of human beings comes from?
I come back to the idea that it's in human nature, that as the Bible says, God created human beings in his image, which means it doesn't matter what your capacities are, doesn't matter what your race is, doesn't matter what your gender is, any of those things, that you bear that value and that dignity, and everything else flows from there, including, as I've said time and time again, which is hugely important to me, as I know it is to Peter, how we treat the non-human creation, that I have a duty that comes from there to the rest of the non-human world that God has made, which I can also, of course, see as a gift of the same God who made me.
Andy, Peter, thank you both for being on the program today.
Thank you, Justin, and thank you, Andy. It's been a pleasure talking.
Likewise, Peter. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming all this way. And Justin, thanks for having us both.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the Big Conversation series here on Unbelievable. Do go and watch again at the website, thebigconversation.show. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter. A huge thank you to the Templeton Religion Trust, who have made this series possible. And I had a tweet recently from someone, Dan Smith, who said, "Can we get around to, this has been one of the best shows of the year for me, tops any Netflix season. Can we please get an Unbelievable Big Conversation 2019 season?" Well, Dan, you're in luck. We are hoping to bring you a second season of High Profile Debates next year. So watch this space. And thank you for listening. And perhaps you yourself have joined the good ship Unbelievable since finding the Big Conversation online. But whether you're a long-time listener or new, if you'd like to email your thoughts about today's show, do get in touch. unbelievable@premier.org.uk or at our Facebook page, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, or on Twitter, @UnbelievableJB is my handle. You can comment at the show page too, and subscribe to the podcast, of course, at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievableJB. Unbelievable. Thanks for being with me on the show. The Profile is here next with David Stroud of Christchurch, London. For now, let me tell you what's coming up on this programme next week.
You're unbelievable.
Michael Roos joins me on the show again, this time to debate Darwinism, Christianity and War with Christian guest Professor Nigel Bigger of Oxford University. That's marking the centenary of the end of World War One, which is coming up in just a week's time, as they debate pacifism, Christianity, nature, red in tooth and claw and just war theory on next week's show. Thanks for being with me. See you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.